I'm happy this evening to introduce our guest speaker, Jane Ryer. And Jane has been on a spiritual path since she was a child. She has a law degree and has spent much of her life defending the earth and its inhabitants from mining waste in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. She has a wide variety of other experiences also. And she began on the Dharma path in 1982 and has practiced in both the Zen and Vipassana tradition. In her effort to devote herself to awakening, she has spent the last 6 years working at retreat centers and monasteries. She practiced and cooked at the Aranya Bodhi Monastery in the, which is the newly founded Vipassana Nuns Monastery in the mountains of north of San Francisco. And the past 4 years were spent at Tassajara Zen Center, which is south of San Francisco, which is a retreat center during the summers and a monastery during the winter time. And during that time, she has stayed in touch with Common Ground. She lived for several years in Grand Marais. So she returned this spring to Minnesota and now resides in Duluth. She has a special interest in the retreat center and the retreat center experiences and other experiences of solitude. And if Common Ground chooses to buy retreat property, it's a possibility that she would live on site if that worked out. She's had a varied life, but the one constant has been her devotion to the path of awakening. And she's here tonight to share some lessons from her monastic experience. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Now, can people hear me? Is the microphone's on? Okay. No? What? You can hear me anyhow? Okay. just let me know. Wave your hands if you don't hear me. I can usually project my voice pretty well.
Could you move your microphone maybe a little?
Would it be in the center more?
Yeah.
Okay. I can't really... I don't see very well with my bifocals. How's that? Is that any better? Okay. Well, I was going to start by telling you a little bit of my history, but I guess Judy already did that. So I kind of want to start out by saying that I don't really believe that, you know, I've kind of come to the belief that there's no such thing really as monasticism, per se, versus lay life. I think it's all, we're all just doing what we do. Each one of us has a life, and we're living it in the place that we're at. And, you know, of course, the surface is the same. The surface is different. The structure is different from one place to another. But really, you know, our life and how we feel inside, the things that we're working on, are the same, whether you're in a monastery or not. And so I just want to say that because I don't have a sense of, like, the monastery as this special place or this special life. Rather, it's just, one way that you might choose to structure your life for a while or long term. So it seems to me that, you know, when people living in various monasteries would get together, or when you went to a new monastery, the first question that monastics would ask each other is, what's your schedule? You know, that the schedule, all important in the monastery. And so I thought I'd just start by describing the schedule at Tassajara, which is the place that I was at the longest. We got up, the wake-up bell was at 3:45 in the morning, and a lot of us, most of us, I'd say, got up at 3:30. I did. You know, we had our coffee group, I was in the coffee group. There was a yoga group, you know, the healthier people, the yoga group. We all kind of had our things that we wanted to do before we started meditation in the morning for various reasons. I wasn't able to stay awake during meditation in the early morning without drinking coffee first, so that's what I did. So through the morning, we'd start with a two-hour alternating sitting and walking meditation, and then we had about a 40-minute service, chanting and bowing service, and then we had Orioke breakfast. For those of you who know what Orioke is, it's a very stylized way of eating that they have in the Zen tradition, where you stay in your meditation seat in the Zendo and stay in meditation posture, and the food is brought around to you, and it's all very stylized with the idea that you continue your meditation through your meals. After that, we'd have a very short, 10-minute bathroom break, and then have an hour study hall. After study hall, through the rest of the morning, it was either back to meditation, or we'd have a Dharma talk or a class. And then we'd have another small short chanting service, and then we would have Orioke lunch. So we were done with all of that by about 12:30. So at 12:30, we'd really put in an 8-hour day with maybe a 15-minute break during that time. And then we had about a 45-minute break, and then we had a 3-hour work period. And then we had an hour and a half that we called bath and exercise time. And that was the only time that you were allowed to go to the bathhouse, which just happened to be a hot spring. You know, this was a hot spring resort in the summertime, basically. So it was a beautiful place. It's absolutely the most charming, picturesque place I have ever lived in my life or ever really been in my life. And, there were so many beautiful things about it. And we were living this, sort of austere life there. So anyway, there was that little bit of free time, and then we'd come back and have another chanting service, another Orioke meal in the Zendo, another short break, and then meditation through the evening. So that was kind of our schedule, and I think that's sort of maybe the epitome of, monasticism, or what people think of monasticism, of just having this very structured life. So I don't want to mislead anybody as to my, who I am, or it was extremely difficult for me. And I wasn't at Zen Center for at Tassajara for 4 years straight. I became notorious for leaving and coming back again. And I think one time Mark said to me, "Boy, Jane, it seems like Tassajara keeps chewing you up and spitting you out." And that's, that's the way it felt. I think everybody there had things that were very difficult for them. And for me, the most difficult thing was a lack of sleep. We went to bed, I didn't say this, the end of the day was at 9:30 at night. So we really only had from 9:30 to 6:30, to sleep. And I just developed a really pretty bad case of insomnia. And so I had a lot of difficulty with sleeping. And that was my particular, cross to bear. Other people had difficulty with the food, situation and the very limited choices of food that we had for people who had various food issues. Or, there were other things that were equally hard for me. Just like in lay life, a lot of times at work, you might be in a situation with people above you who are less competent than you are, or who know less than you do, and who maybe have an attitude or something. All of those things are really They're really there at the monastery and are just as difficult, you know, to deal with there, and sometimes even more so because that person is always there. You don't, you know, at the end of the day, you can't go home and kind of get a break from that person. I think for me, a lot of what was difficult was being with other people all of the time because I'm a very solitary person, and so... But anyway, it doesn't matter what it was, you know, everybody had difficulties. And I think just like everybody has difficulties outside of the monastery. Although I do like to quote Ajahn Sumedho said, in Tibetan practice, they have the practice of 100,000 prostrations. And in monastic practice, we have the practice of 100,000 frustrations, which I thought kind of hit the nail on the head. So I've gone around in circles about what I was doing there. Sometimes it drove me crazy. I remember one time talking to the abbot, one of the abbots there, and saying, you know, Steve, it seems to me like what we're doing is like really making ourselves miserable here and then sitting around and watching how it feels to be miserable. And he said, yeah, that's it, you know. And I thought, that's not what I signed up for, you know. I really thought at the time that what I was doing there and the reason I had chosen Tassajara versus some other monastic setting or other practice place was because of the meditation schedule, that we actually had more time for meditation there than other monasteries that I had visited, and I really thought that's what I was doing there, that I was there to spend as much time as possible in meditation. And I don't really think that anymore. I don't think that's necessarily what I was doing there. I've gone around in circles quite a bit. And I have to say, what led me to being up here tonight, Mark, I was here, you know, a few years ago for a while, and he said, well, sometime, Jane, you should give a talk, you know, on your experience, on your pilgrimage. And so when I was coming back, when I was leaving Tassajara this spring and I was writing to Mark, at the time that I was writing to him, I had this amazing insight into what monastic practice was all about, you know, and I thought, I'll give that talk now, you know. And so I said, you know, I'm ready to give a talk. And so, you know, I felt fine about that, and we set the date, and the months went by, and I had in the back of my mind, you know, I wrote it down in my journal. I don't have to worry about this too much because I wrote it down in my journal. And about a week ago, I went back, and I didn't write it down. Whatever that insight was, I didn't write it down, and I don't remember what it was. So, but I do have a couple thoughts. I'm going to back up a little bit here, and I want to just talk a little bit about the Buddhist path of practice as I understand it, in order to say how I think monastic practice was helpful and how we can use some of those same things in lay life that are helpful at the monastery. So I'm not really a Dogen Zenji person, which was another difficulty for me at Tassajara. But I've always loved what I think is probably his most famous quote, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things, that's the translation that that they use at San Francisco Zen Center. So I don't pretend to be able to talk about what it means to be actualized by the myriad things. And I'm not going to talk about that. It's, my understanding is that it's beyond our conceptual minds, and that can't really be talked about anyway, and I'm not even going to try. So I'm going to take it a step back and start by talking a little bit about forgetting the self, which I kind of take as my, you know, my goal, if you will, or my, you know, the direction that I'm looking to. And I really like the word forgetting. I like that translation, forgetting the self, because I think forgetting really captures something about the difficulty of this. Because forgetting isn't something that we can really do by willing ourselves to do it. It's something that we kind of have to approach in a different way. We can talk about letting go of the self, but sometimes letting go of the self makes us feel like, well, we should be able to just do it. You know, we should be able to just drop it. And of course, we can't just drop it. And we need to engage in a little bit in a, you know, maybe a more sideways path. I think that this core of letting this core, you know, whatever it is, of forgetting the self or letting go of the self is really important, or perhaps, you know, kind of a key element of virtually every religion, and that it gets covered over by a lot of stuff, and it's approached in different ways, and it's talked about in different ways, but I think it's really sort of the crux of spiritual life, you know, across religions. And I think that you could even approach an understanding of various religions and how they differ through understanding how they approach the question of how are you going to go about this? And because it's extremely difficult. We have a situation where, you know, pretty much everything we do is self-centered. It involves ourself and our sense of self, our desires for ourself. And I came across a quote from Martin Luther, of all people. A saint is someone who understands the fact that everything he does is egotistical. And it kind of sums up the human condition, that because this sense of self is involved in all of our thinking, it's very, very difficult. It's not a situation that we can approach just through sort of a straightforward motive to do this. So to me, I think one of the amazing insights that Shakyamuni Buddha had was that our suffering arises from this sense of self, that it is that this kind of pervasive dukkha that is a part of the experience of being human arises from that same kind of core of thought and emotion that, you know, makes up our sense of self. And therefore, if we approach our practice with a motive of ending our suffering, we're going to be undermining our core of self. I don't know if I'm saying that clearly, but I think it's really important to my understanding of what I'm doing. So so that's about forgetting the self, and then taking the step back is to study the Buddha way is to study the self, and to study the self is to forget the self. So to me, you know, the core practice, the most important practice is what I've come to think of as self-observation. You know, we can call it being mindful, or there are many different names for it. But for me, it comes down to really paying attention to my internal state and what is going on inside. And I think another very key insight that the Buddha had, that observing ourselves very closely leads to being able to let go of ourselves. And another way to say that might be studying suffering leads to the end of suffering. So I think if we watch our emotions and mind states and perceptions as they arise, and we pay very close attention, and we really have the understanding or the view that that this sense of self that we feel is part of what we need to watch, part of what we need to really pay attention to and see what's going on with. I think that is the crux of my practice anyway. So I'm going to, just to give an example, I'll back up a little bit. I was talking about different religions and their various ways of approaching this problem of how do we let go of ourselves. And I think, you know, it's occurred to me many times over the years that God has been a very, very successful concept. It's and for, you know, if you can have that strong belief in God, and it's something to give yourself up to. And I think that guru yoga can be the same way. Certainly in the Pure Land sect of Buddhism, there's also that giving yourself up to the other. So that's one way to go, and it's occurred to me that the monastic tradition, at least in Zen, I don't know about other traditions, but that just the schedule maybe could be enough to kind of give up your own ideas of what you want to do and to sort of just give yourself up to the schedule. And certainly the mantra at Tassajara was just follow the schedule. You know, whatever else, you know, you can complain, you can, whatever you do, but bottom line, just follow the schedule. And so there was quite a while that I was there that I thought that what I was trying to do was kind of give up my own will to the schedule. And because I was somebody who was not going to give up my own will to another human being, that doesn't feel safe to me, and it's not something I'm going to do, that actually trusting an institution that has a schedule that I've looked at, and, you know, I'm not getting enough sleep, but that's not really the end of the world. That seemed like maybe what I was doing. For a while, I thought that was what I was doing. I don't think that that was really what I was doing now. I'm really back to really thinking that I went there to suffer. When I left, you know, what I said to people was, I needed to wander in the hell realms for 6 years. And this was a good place, it was a good place to do that, I don't think I'm done wandering in the hell realms. I think as human beings, we all spend time wandering in the hell realms. And I think that it's really helpful to us in eventually letting go of the self. And the reason I think that is because I think that being in a situation where you have those difficult mind states really bring up that me feeling. And so they really give you the opportunity to study the self. I think I've kind of, for a long time, I thought, well, you should be able to, you know, just turn your attention to those really pleasant mind states as well, you know. Let's do that. And but I've noticed with myself that it has been more helpful to me to really experience that self, you know. I've kind of come to think of it, the phrase I use for it now is a subjective bias, that I've noticed that I have this this feeling. It's like I want something and therefore I should have it. It's not just I want it, but you know, all the things that you do that you kind of know that you shouldn't do, and you do them anyway because you. Joseph Goldstein, I think it is, talks in one of his books about a student who had a lot of pain in her knee, and she was moving a lot, and he was suggesting to her that she was maybe disturbing other people, and maybe she should just attempt to sit still for the whole meditation period. And she said, "But my knee really hurts." And he said, "I know, but there are, you know, the room is full of people whose knees hurt." And she said, "Yes, but this is my knee, you know." And when I first read that, it didn't really make an impression on me. It was kind of, you know, it just seemed like kind of a little throwaway story. But then as I was paying more and more attention to myself and the things that I was going through, it was kind of like that really is kind of the crux of it, the crux of this self that we labor under and that causes us so much misery. So I wanted to tell a little bit of a story from the monastery. One week out of the month or so, we had a little bit more of an intensive schedule, which just meant mostly that we didn't have a work time, and our, you know, bath exercise time was shortened, and we spent more of that time in the Zendo. And on those weeks, we had tea in the afternoon, which was also Orioki style, and someone brought along around tea, and we had tea and a cookie. We got a cookie. And and the cookie was very important. And, so there was somebody sitting next to me who was a friend of mine. He was a really wonderful person, but he always made a point of taking the biggest cookie. And I actually got they came by me first, and I could have taken the biggest cookie, but I had this rule for myself that I was just going to take the cookie that was the closest to me, you know, on the tray, and I really wanted that bigger cookie. So Nathan would always, and you know, he didn't make it, he didn't hide this or anything, you know, it was like I was judging him every day. Every day I'd come through here and I'd have this judgment of this person next to me who was taking the cookie that I wanted, I think, you know, really. And so it was a really good situation for me to be able to feel that, you know, that I want, this is, and it's not nice, you know. It's like, it's so painful. It's so painful to really see yourself, and to really know, you know, to really know how we are and how we, there was another thing I did. I was kind of at the end of the line, filing out of the Zendo when we were done with meditation. And everything would back up because people had to put their shoes on. And so I'd be waiting, you know, and waiting. I'd waiting, getting impatient. I was impatient. And one time I even kind of snuck ahead of everybody. And I was really embarrassed by that. I was really kind of mortified that I had done that. I could just feel, I think impatience is a really, really helpful emotion. You really feel that me, you know. when you're feeling impatient. So it seems to me that the monastery, what it gave us was, you know, some misery, and then the space and the time to actually be able to turn our attention to it. Because I think that difficulty, difficult situations, difficult mind states are really helpful, but they're only helpful if you really pay attention, if you take the time to really turn your mind to them and see what they can teach you. And I think that that's our greatest difficulty probably in lay life is finding that space to do that. So I guess what I would, you know, what I have to suggest to you tonight is a couple of things, a couple of ways to take the time during the day to slow down and, you know, experience what it is you're experiencing, to really turn your mind to it. I think if you can get into the habit of pausing, I think that really the ideal is to, well, the ideal is not so much to sit on your cushion all day, you know, but to stay mindful all day, to really be aware of what you're feeling continuously throughout the day. Well, that's, you know, that's very difficult, and you have to start somewhere, and I think a good place to start is to pause throughout the day, to get into the habit of pausing. Each time you feel that rub of life, to just pause. Don't pause to try to get rid of it or to, talk yourself out of it, to make it go away, but just pause to actually feel it. And another thought that occurred to me about this is, I think that what we're doing when we do that, when we really feel what we're feeling rather than talking to ourselves about it or trying to talk ourselves out of it, is giving the intelligence that dwells in our mind and body, perhaps below our conscious thinking, that I really think dwells in maybe in all matter, certainly in all living things, giving it honest information, giving honest information to this mind-body system, rather than feeding it misinformation through, you know, all of the gymnastics that we go through in our heads trying to get away from what it is that we're actually feeling. So, I think impatience is a really, really good teacher. I think a lot of us have recurring situations in our lives that make us impatient. One of the wonderful things about impatience is that usually if you're impatient, it means that you've got a little bit of time because you're frustrated that things aren't happening fast enough. So computers often make us impatient, and waiting of any kind often makes us impatient. That's a really good time to turn your attention inward and just, you know, get in the habit of really experiencing what it is that you are actually experiencing. You can think of other times during the day that are maybe particular times for you where you have to do something that you don't want to do. Maybe getting up in the morning is difficult for you if you have a job that you don't really want to go to every day. Maybe before you get up, just sit up in bed for 5 minutes and experience how you feel not wanting to go. Just, you know, how does that feel? Not talking yourself into wanting to go and not having the expectation that it's going to change, that if you just sit here for 5 minutes, you're going to jump out of bed and, you know, it's going to be great. You're still going to have to probably make yourself get out of bed. But it's also very interesting, I think, and helpful to watch that happen. It's like, how does that happen? You know, here I am. I don't want to do this, and I'm doing it anyway. And what does that mean? You know? So all of those things that are just times in your life when things are difficult for you, that you can actually make space in your life to observe them. I think that's probably the best thing that the monastery gave me and what I really find helpful going on in my life. So, let's see. There was one other thing I was going to say about, you know, what I think was really happening at the monastery, and that was, I came across this little book in the Tassajara Library that I thought was so interesting. It's called The Observing Self. And I think the subtitle is something like Psychotherapy and Mysticism. It's not about Buddhism. And in fact, there are parts of it that are really contrary to Buddhist thought. But it was an excellent discussion of letting go of the self and of self-observation. And he makes the point in it. The author did a survey of mystic traditions and experiences, and he talks some about purification practices and how the mystic traditions, many of them have purification practices, and what you're purifying, what the purification is about, is purifying your motives. And it gets back to the idea that it's very, very difficult for us to do anything that isn't self, you know, to serve ourselves, to, you know, whether it's making ourselves better, thinking better of having a better self-image, or having other people think better of us, or whatever it is, you know, that it's very difficult for us to get away from that. And so, you know, it seems to me, you hear a lot of stories about, you know, crazy wisdom and these teachers that a student goes to them and they have them spend, you know, 20 years building a building and taking it apart again and building it and taking it apart again. I think that's a purification practice. And I can't exactly define purification practice, but I think it has to do with doing things, continuing to do things after you've gotten to the point where you really don't feel like they're helping you anymore. They don't really feel like they're doing anything for you. And I think that's, you know, the 100,000 prostrations, that's why there's 100,000 of them, is because, you know, once you get up there in those numbers, it's just like you're no longer, hopefully, maybe thinking, you know, my teacher's going to think I'm really great because I'm doing these so quickly or whatever, you know. And towards the end of being at Tassajara, I started to think that all of the sitting that that they do in many Zen monasteries and maybe other monasteries as well, at some point becomes a purification practice, that you're just doing it, you know, because that's the life that you've taken up, and that's what you're doing, and you're no longer really thinking that it's going to get you somewhere. So for what that's worth, you know, just thought I'd throw it in there. So I think that that's all I'm going to say, and I think we have about 10 minutes for questions or comments. Yes.
So I agree with all of this, but I feel like every day I'm frustrated, and that feels kind of, I'm focusing on myself. So when I hear your experience with a not great understanding of background, I'm like,
I don't mind if it's judgmental.
Isn't that like the most egotistical, self-centered thing to be like, I'm just going to focus on myself? Wouldn't it be better to like have the Catholic approach and be like, I'm going to sacrifice and I'm going to do what I'm doing? the planet and never mind about me. I'm going to try to, you know, like, channel your energy another way that you're doing good and, like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. And I think we all go through those questions and have times when we just feel like this is too self-centered. For myself, first of all, I don't think that it's a choice of one or the other. I think that you can really, pay attention to your internal state even while you're doing things for other people. And I tell you, at the monastery, there is a lot of soul searching about that. A lot of people feeling like this is too focused on myself. I need to be out there doing things. And that I would say is the number one reason why people don't stay longer than they do, at least at Tazahara where I was at. But I also think that there is something that we don't understand about the interconnectedness of all beings, and that on some level we are not separate people. We are not, and I don't experience this, and so it's a little bit difficult to talk about it. But I guess I do believe that transforming my own consciousness is the best thing that I can do for the whole. And I don't understand it, and yet it's something that I have some faith in. Yes?
One of the things I experienced when we went through the meditation, focusing on mind states, was all the suffering has to do with the abandonment of the self, leaving the self in order to avoid the state, not feel it, not be there. And when I make contact and I say, oh, this is how, you know, when I follow what you're saying, like, this is how it is, then I relax. And I had emotion and I felt free. So it isn't necessarily the forgetting of the self. It's not really a forgetting. It's making contact so that you can't forget. It's being connected instead of disconnected.
Yeah. Yeah.
That I spent all my life being disconnected because I grew up with all kinds of insecurity, all of them. And the thing that happens is when I connect to myself, I'm more secure. I'm okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Anyone else? Yes.
Yeah, I guess I kind of had that same sense when you were talking about just stick with the schedule. Like, that's what a lot of people are doing in the monastery, just, you know, keep going with the schedule. Mm-hmm. It all seemed like, so to do what? To sort of just kind of numb out and, you know, just, you know, robotic state or something? I mean, what's the goal of just stick with the schedule for a time? Kind of think? I mean, that's...
Well,
think about how complicated life is and stuff. So I just wondered, in a way, like, why you would just go with the schedule.
Well, it's not something I think that is rational. It's and that's the thing about trying to talk about, like, a purification practice. I mean, that was really one of what really felt like a deep insight at the time about when I read this book, was that, oh, the schedule is a purification practice. And it is really difficult to talk about because it's a way of giving up your self-motivation. And I think that that's what it's good for. But it does involve... It involves maybe quite a lot of your life that really doesn't seem to be of use or benefit to anyone. And I think that we all, this is part of our ego, you know, is feeling that we need to that we're important, that what we do is important, and that all of our time needs to be given to something with a purpose. And I'm not saying on some level that that isn't true, because, you know, on some level it is true. But also on some level, if we want to, you know, if we really want to transform ourselves, we also have to let go of that. And it's that conundrum of how we let go of it, I think, that has made some of those things useful that don't really make any sense, and that we also kind of, you know, argue against a lot in our minds. Yes?
I'm curious about what you're doing in Duluth and how your monastic experiences have affected the way you're living your life.
Well, I am fighting the new mines in northern Minnesota is what I'm doing in Duluth. So I don't know if that's an issue that you follow. If you don't, you know, I don't want to go into it too much here. But, I think, you know, I've given myself a lot of freedom, from a schedule, this summer. I thought, you know, I had this idea that I was going to come back and kind of set up a schedule and stick with it and all of that, and I haven't done that so much. I do, you know, I think I sit every day. I do puja chanting every day. And I think that having had that schedule for so long has really helped me have a, you know, a really regular routine. But I think more than that, it's it's been a very, very slow progress. Very slow, very, very slow progress to try to, you know, to be a little bit more mindful throughout the day, to maintain my mindfulness through the day. And I don't think that that's necessarily because I was at the monastery. I think it's just, I think that practitioners see that regardless, that, you know, I just happened to have been in and out of this monastery I was there for 4 out of the last 6 years. And so now I can look back at those 6 years and say, wow, look what that monastic life gave me. But I can't really say what it's given me that I wouldn't have developed anyway, you know, if I had been living a lay life during that time, because I have been really intent on my practice even before I went to the monastery. So, yes.
What kind of work
for the 3 hours?
I'm sorry. What
kind of work for the 3 hours? Okay. We had 3 month practice periods at a time, and we had 2 each year, one in the fall and one in the winter, and then we ran the place as a resort in the summertime. So in the summertime, we didn't have that schedule, and we were working full time. In the wintertime, for the 3 month practice period, you would have a job assigned to you. And it was a huge range of things. You know, you might be working in the kitchen, prepping, or, you might be working in the garden or on the grounds. Let's see, you know, one person kept the swimming pool clean or cleaned the bathhouse or, you know, just all of those kind of regular jobs. Anyone else?
What did you do in study hall?
In study hall was completely, you were limited to Dharma books or, you know, that which was very loosely interpreted. I read, for instance, I reread William James's The Varieties of Religious Experience during my last 3 month period. You just choose your own book. Was there someone? Yes.
Did you ever do any energy sublimation practices or like yoga practices, open four wings, sun, varyana?
Nope. I didn't. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. I could. It's an alternate area of why you sit. You just sit because you want to open your four channels. You want to sublimate your energy. That's sort of balanced. Mariana, I know we have a little bit of yoga, certain yoga poses, they call it yoga tantra, and then you have to get in parts. But there's also some, that's another view of how to practice the balance.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.